Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremiah Polacek, your co-pilot on the pathway to becoming a better painter, or maybe just a better art lover in general. Today we're going to be looking at the life and work of German-American painter Hans Hofmann, his legacy, what he's left behind, what he forged while he was living. Let's get into it. So Hans was born in a small town in Bavaria called Weißenburg in 1880, and his parents were both well-educated people, and in 1886, when he was 6 years old, they would all move to Munich because his dad got a job there. It was here that Hans was shown to have an unusual talent for inventing things, and by the time he was just 16 years old, he had already made numerous devices. These things included stuff like an electromagnetic comptometer, a radar device for ships, a sensitized light bulb, and a portable freezer. So imagine somebody at 16 years old who's making all this sort of stuff. They must have this, you know, brilliant career ahead of them in science and mathematics, and he's basically a genius. I don't know if we should say genius, but he certainly shows an unusual talent and ability at age 16, working for the military, designing a portable freezer, I guess maybe a cooler. Maybe he designed a cooler, right? Anyway, he was a talented kid. And all that would change when he starts studying art. He meets this guy, Moritz Heimann, and he begins to study painting with him. And this meeting began this transition from science to artistic expression. So who was Moritz Heimann? It was hard to find a lot of information on him, but I did a little bit of digging and found out that he studied at the Academy of Arts in Berlin from 1890 to 1892, and he relocated to Munich at the age of 23 in 1893, where he'd attend the Academy of Fine Arts in Munich till 1895, and he studied under the master studio of Karl von Marr. And I looked up some of Karl von Marr's paintings, and they're kind of typical mythological genre paintings and these sorts of things. But anyway, Moritz also took a study trip to northern Italy, went to Venice, studied all these places. It's fun to think about these young artists going around Venice in 1899, isn't it? I want to be that art student. Anyway, we are where we are, aren't we? And so he starts this school in Munich, and he starts his own painting school, which is kind of cool, isn't it? It's really nice. It's what I've done, I guess, which is why I think it's cool, because I have Oko Academy here in Prague. But he starts his own painting school. So he's outside of the academy, and he's just taking his own private students, so to speak. And Hans Hofmann wanders in one day, and I'm sure the prospect of teaching such a brilliant young mind was very appealing to Moritz as well, and they begin to study together. And this marks Hans Hofmann's departure into paint. It's with Moritz. A little bit about Moritz, because we won't get back to him. He continues to operate his school until 1933. Guess who closes it? You guessed right. It's the Nazis. And then 2 years later, he would unfortunately commit suicide by jumping off a bridge. So pour one out for Moritz, please, because he gave us Hans Hofmann. All right, getting back to Hans Hofmann now. So we're right at the turn of the 20th century. It's about 1900. And Hans is studying with Moritz in Munich. It was during this time Hans would be out hobnobbing with other people as well, because there's a lot going on in Munich, right? There's all these types of cultural events, and Hans is part of this intellectual society. And it was probably at one of these meetings, or one of these gatherings, that he would meet his future wife, Maria Wolfegg, who would go by the name Ms. Also during this time, he bumps into this guy, Philip Freudenberg, who would become a pivotal figure in his life. Freudenberg was the owner of a high-end department store in Berlin, an avid art collector, and he was super rich. And among all that, he also loved Hofmann's work. He saw great potential in him, and he became Hofmann's patron. It was this support that became a game changer for Hofmann at such an early stage in his life. He had a new wife, Ms., and they made the jump together with support from Freudenberg to move to Paris. And Paris at the time, this is 1900, in Paris. Where else would you want to be, really? But Paris, at the time, was an epicenter of artistic innovation and avant-garde movements. So a lot of the avant-garde is just beginning to bubble up to the surface. And Hoffman, who had studied with Moritz, and we all love Moritz, he's great, but how can we say this? Moritz was a bit of an impressionist, I guess we could say. And if you look at some of Hoffman's early paintings, for instance, he has a painting of his wife, Miz, done in 1902, and you can look at that painting and you'll see a very traditional, kind of loose, brushy, figural painting and interior. And that's kind of what Hoffman was doing in Munich. Now, when he relocated to Paris, he gets exposed to a lot of different ideas and movements and approaches to painting, and that would drastically change the way he painted as well. Hoffman would study at two renowned institutions I can barely pronounce, but they are Académie de... What the hell? I'm just going to translate this. Okay, so there's no translation when I put it into Google, but basically it's the Académie Chaumière and Académie Colarossi, and these are both very important academies in Paris at the time. It almost makes no sense when we begin to think about the all the artists that were just wandering around Paris at this time. So we've got Pablo Picasso there, we've got Matisse there, beginning Fauvism, using color in these completely new and dynamic ways. We have George Braque, who's creating Cubism, which would also be important in all these geometric forms and fragmented subjects and these sorts of things. We have Leger, who's also associated with Cubism, but his work would evolve into more figurative styles. We have Jan Gries, both of the Delaunays, Sonia and Robert. We've got Modigliani wandering around, Brancusi building sculptures to the sky. Marc Chagall is there. Marcel Duchamp is doing Lord knows what, probably playing chess against himself. And we have all these different people exactly at the same time that Hans Hoffman is like 24 years old and studying at the Academy in Paris. So he is being absolutely inundated with the leading figures of painting in the 20th century at one of the most pivotal moments in the history of painting within the 20th century, which comes, you know, right at the beginning of it. So this period in Paris would obviously completely revolutionize his ideas, his practices, and it would, you know, play a significant role in shaping his artistic development and how he thought about painting and how he approached painting. Because Hoffman, of course, is known for his paintings. We can get into what they look like. Google them out on your phone. You know, they're geometric abstractions. We'll get into the details of his paintings in a bit. But think about the environment that nurtured these ideas. Think about where Hoffman came from and where he landed. And he must have just been so curious about the world. And it must have been such an exciting time to be such a brilliant mind and also rub shoulders with somebody like Matisse or Picasso. But these were just, you know, studio visits. You get a studio visit from Matisse. The person that really influenced Hoffman to a great extent was somebody he wouldn't have these types of interactions with, who's often considered the grandfather of all these others, and that is Cézanne. And Cézanne, he died in 1906. So he would have died right around the time that Hoffman is studying and going to school. And Hoffman would be looking at these Cézanne paintings and looking at the abstractions that were created in this interplay between abstraction and representation that was present within these works. And he got really interested in that. How do you make things flat? How do you push things back in space? How do you pull things forward in space? And what role does color have in that effect? So he's looking at Cézanne a lot, and he's making all these paintings, and he's beginning, you can see the seeds of these geometric forms beginning to be planted in these ideas of just focusing on pure abstraction. And to further, and just to place where we are in history, it's in 1907 is when Picasso would paint the Women of Avignon, which of course you can Google and is often considered to be one of the first Cubist paintings. So we're around that same time period that all these other paintings are developing, that Hans is also making his paintings, and he's standing out in his own regard as well at this time. So he's not really necessarily a student in a lot of ways, but he's somebody actively contributing to the current zeitgeist of the time. But it wasn't just the geometric forms of cubism that began to soak into the approach that Hoffman had to painting. There was also a lot of other factors all combining to create his vision of the world. Among them would also be Fauvism, which of course was popularized by Henri Matisse. And this would emphasize these very, very bold and expressive colors. And Hoffman would adopt this technique, using color not just for representation, but as an independent expressive element within his paintings. Alongside this, we've also got expressionism beginning to surface as well. And artists sought to express meaning and emotional experience rather than physical reality. So the dependence upon the academy and looking at the world and accurately representing it onto the canvas becomes less and less important, and this idea of emotional intensity and expressionism begins to become more and more important. Another factor is the rise of color theory and what's called Orphism. Now, the Orphism movement is associated with Robert and Sonia Delaunay, and it's focused on pure abstraction and vivid colors. And Hoffman was influenced by their use of simultaneous contrasts and color theory. So just how you lay down a green and a red together in that beautiful glow that you get between them, you can start to incorporate these things into the painting. So we're thinking about how do two colors interact when they're next to each other. It seems like a common thing that we may approach in a painting now because we're so used to abstract painting and so used to experience paintings, or just used to having a wall that's painted blue with a red design on top of it or whatever. We can see these vibrations very, very clearly. But to focus solely on that idea of that vibration of colors is something that color theory and Orphism also represents. And that's also coming up to the surface at this time. Of course, in addition to all of this, we have a structural analysis of Cézanne's post-impressionist works as well, which are these compositions that use color, you know, these large planes of shapes, and then there's slight color modulations between them. And as I said before, this approach to color, this approach to planes, when I talk about planes, I mean flat planes, you know what I mean? Like plane surfaces, right? Not approaching the world as light and shadow, but you can also approach it as planes in space, kind of like everything's boxes inside of boxes, like we're looking at the world as if it's the wire mesh of a 3D design. There's also a very direct approach that becomes evident in a lot of painting during this time. So we're approaching paintings very directly. There's not a lot of time to, you know, redo all your brush strokes and make everything smooth and worry about all these little things. It's a very quick, spontaneous approach to making paintings. You know, we're in the beginnings of abstract representations as well. So just pure abstraction, as we're talking about, it doesn't need to be a pot. It doesn't need to be a duck and a still life. You can make a painting of just a rectangle inside of another rectangle, and that's okay. That's when it begins. And as I mentioned before, I brought up this idea of push and pull. And push and pull is so, it's such a common phrase that's uttered in so many studio visits and critiques and all these sorts of things. This idea that some colors want to pull forward in space and other colors want to push back farther in space. A very, very simple representation of this might be when you look at atmospheric perspective, maybe in like a Da Vinci painting or something like this, you look towards the horizon and you'll see towards the horizon, there's kind of this ultramarine, very, very light blue. And it feels like that blue should be farther away. When you see all these entertainment design, you know, video game designs or whatever, you'll see it all the time. They use the same idea. You know, warmer colors come forward, colder colors go back. And Hoffman is somebody who becomes very, very interested in that very simple concept. Where does a color lie in space? Where do we place a color in space? Regardless of if this overlaps this, or this should be in front of this, we can play with overlap later. But where does that color exist in space? It's kind of like thinking about where a note would exist in space, you know, like a musical note, C or whatever. Where is C? Where is A? We kind of have this feeling that they should be somewhere. And Hoffman's approach to science in his analytical thinking, I'm sure, also played a role in the formulation of this theory about colors existing on different planes in space. It's a different way of experiencing the world. So everything is going well, and Hoffman is making strides into his approach to painting and getting into all sorts of great intellectual discussions. And what happens, the beginning of World War I happens. And, you know, we often think of, you know, what happens to normal people when a war begins. And Hoffman's story is similar to many other artists. And in Paris, you know, one thing is Hoffman is a foreigner. He's a German living in Paris. And when countries go to war, there's mobilizations, but there's also a rise in nationalism. There tends to be this, you know, this nationalistic fervor that's accompanied by a country going to war. And that can also lead to a lot of suspicion of immigrants. And Hoffman and many of these other artists kind of existed in this world where they were apart from French society, but they were very much a part of it. But they could definitely be seen as outsiders or as interlopers. So there was more and more hostility directed towards them. The war, of course, would also bring instability to these areas. And in times of instability, artwork and paintings, these sorts of things are, you know, some of the first things to go when you have to keep the water running, have to keep, you know, these things, the electricity on. So art becomes less important. So all these different institutions, when the war begins, all these different institutions that had spent years and years being created, a lot of them just vanish overnight. The directors are gone. Now, Hoffman would be called up for military service, but due to a respiratory condition, he was actually exempted. But there's a general climate of war, and he leaves Paris. He's left Paris. He's gone back to his hometown. You know, maybe part of it is also he just wants to be around his family during these difficult times. And he moves back to Munich. And it's 1915. War has begun. And what does Hoffman decide to do? He decides he wants to open his own school. Now, I imagine, you know, he studied at Moritz's school, his own private school, 15 years previous before he moved to Paris. I couldn't help but think, you know, maybe during that time in Paris, he kind of had a dream or an idea of establishing his own school back in Munich, or something about that period of time resonated with him. Or it was something where, like, you know, all I need is a room and some students and some canvas and paints, and I'll have my own school. And so Hans Hoffman opens the Hans Hoffman School of Art in Munich in 1915. And this is despite the war. Munich really remained an important cultural center in Germany at the time. And the facilities and, you know, specifics of what the school would have, of course, would be very, very modest because, you know, it's wartime. So I imagine you're looking at the bare bones in terms of materials, you know, paper, paint, maybe canvas, some easels, these sorts of things. So it's a very bare bones approach. But what he makes up for in facilities, when we think about what did Hans Hoffman's facilities look like? When we think about that, probably not much. But he made up for it with his teaching philosophy and his approach and his method. And he came from Paris. So he comes from the place everything's happening and everybody knows everything is happening, right, in Paris. So he comes back to Munich, which is by its own right an important city, but it's not Paris. So all these other people, I'm sure, are interested in studying with somebody who had direct access to all these sorts of ideas and approaches in painting. And Hoffman's teaching methods would be very, very progressive for the time. For instance, he would emphasize studying nature, but not for directly imitating it, but just as a source of inspiration for the understanding of form, color, and space. So they would set up a still life in the class, and you don't have to approach the still life as, oh, is this leaf in front of this leaf? You don't have to approach it like that. You can just approach the still life just as color. How does that green work with that green? How does that shadowed green go back in space? And it doesn't need to be accurately represented or imitative of what you see. So he had this approach to painting that begins to resonate with others. He creates an entire curriculum alongside this teaching philosophy that he embodied as well. And of course, we see how Cubism and Fauvism are both important as well in his teaching, because his teaching has a lot to do with color and it has a lot to do with planes in space. Well, you know, these rectangles in space. And his school begins to get a lot of attention internationally. So you think of, you know, an artist who makes his own private school, which is just him, begins to attract all these people from all over the world, and they all want to study with him. And this type of notoriety leads to visiting artist engagements and these sorts of things. And Hoffman would fly to California and lecture there for a while in 1930. And that's when he first got his first taste of America, was during that trip in 1930. In the subsequent years, we're talking about Germany, 1931. What else is happening? Right, it's the Nazis again. And they hate Hoffman. They think his art is degenerate. Why aren't you painting a nice young man, you know, carrying some wheat up a hill as his wife makes a pie in the background and, you know, whatever. Like, they want social realistic garbage. And Hoffman represents everything they absolutely hate about art. 1932, we talked about Moritz, you know, his school gets shut down. And he's, you know, by all standards, he's much more conservative than Hoffman is. So if they're going to shut down Moritz's school, obviously Hoffman is next. And we don't want him to suffer the same fate as Moritz, who jumped off the bridge. So instead, Hoffman during this period decides to flee Germany, and he moves where he had that initial connection. He moves to California, where he begins teaching at the University of California, Berkeley. And after a few years there, he's got the itch. He wants to move back to the hustle and bustle, the new artistic mecca, which is New York City. And it's there where he establishes the Hans Hoffman School of Art, which was initially located in Manhattan. And this place provided an environment where students could engage directly with the New York art scene. And that was very important for Hoffman as well. And in Hoffman, in addition to having this school in Manhattan, would open a summer school in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is this this beautiful town, which continues to have an amazing artist residency to this day. But he would open up these two schools that were just his own creation, and his students would be able to interact and show their work within the galleries, because he knew all the people. He knew the people that ran the museums. He knew the people that ran the galleries. And amongst all the other advice out there, if anybody is giving you advice about how do you get into a gallery, how do I get my work into a gallery? Well, there's a lot of important steps, but a big one is be friends with the person that owns the gallery. And so that's what Hoffman is. He's part of the entire art scene, and he's bringing in these students, and they're creating this work, and they're experimenting together in the creation of this work and in the approach to this work. And then their works are also filtering out directly into the galleries in New York City, one of the most important art cities in the world at the time, if not the most important art city in the world. And many of his students would go on to become some of the major figures in abstract expressionist movement. And many of his students would go on to become major figures in the abstract expressionist movement, including artists like Lee Krasner, Helen Frel. And many of his students would go on to become major figures in the abstract expressionist movement, including artists like Lee Krasner, Helen Frankenthaler, and Ray Eames. So he has these amazing students coming through. Of course, Lee Krasner would marry Jackson Pollock. That was her husband. And probably influenced him as well in that respect, were the teachings of Hans Hofmann. But he's teaching the people at the cutting edge of abstract expressionism at the time. And when we look at Hans Hofmann's paintings, we don't really see a lot of this splatter and pizzazz. We see kind of a calm, contemplative approach to color in these little squares. There's a lushness in the brush strokes, that's for sure. But it's not this energetic, explosive painting that we see with somebody like Helen Frankenthaler. And so I think an important thing to realize is in art education, we're coming out of the art academy model. And Hans Hofmann has this approach to teaching which allows for a student to make up their own approach. That's probably a very, very new thing in the history of art education in some respects. What other time? I don't know. Somebody could probably correct me. But what other time was there an academy model that allowed for students to find their own voice? The goal was not to replicate a Hans Hofmann painting. The goal was not to be his apprentice and imitate him. The goal was to approach color and think about color in a way that helps you realize your own artistic voice. And from what I've read, he had a very particular way of challenging students about certain ideas and getting them to explore. And I think that's a really interesting way of teaching, where you're teaching somebody to explore rather than teaching them what to do. And Hofmann would continue teaching at his own school some of the best and brightest artists in the world for more than two decades until 1958. And he's 78 years old now at this time, and he would retire from teaching to concentrate fully on his own painting. And this decision would mark the beginning of an intensely productive and creative phase of his career. That's one of the great things about painting, right? You can be 78 and it's like, here we go. And that's basically how Hans Hofmann felt. He had given decades and decades of his life to all these students. And now finally, he had a time to just completely explore exactly what he wanted to explore in his own works and with his own voice. And his work was very, very well received. And he got a ton of recognition during this period and had numerous solo exhibitions. And his paintings were featured in major galleries and museums throughout the country and throughout the world. He would have, you know, he'd be in the Whitney and the Museum of Modern Art in 1963, these types of places. And so he's at the top of his game, so to speak, in his late career as well. And in most of these paintings, you know, he's 80 years old or so, and they're characterized by this very, very bold use of color and dynamic composition in a real emotional intensity. And that's one thing I love about these older works as well, is just the intensity never slows down. Throughout his entire career, we never see it slow down. And because of this intensity, because of his notoriety and just how much he probably gave to the world in terms of his approach to painting and how many people it influenced, it was extremely well received, as I said. In 1963, his wife Ms. would die during surgery, and this would be a very, very profound loss for Hofmann, and he would make a painting for her. It's titled, To Ms. Pax Vobiscum, which means, Peace be with you, Ms. And this was a great loss for Hofmann, but despite it, he would continue to innovate in his art, experimenting with form, composition, and maintaining his position at the forefront of the abstract expressionist movement. His later years would be characterized by an extremely prolific approach to painting, where he made hundreds and hundreds of works, the chronology of which is not completely known. So sign the back of your paintings, kids. But he would be extremely prolific in his later years, and you could see these kind of as a summation of his entire life's work that was created in these final works. Hans Hofmann would die in New York City in 1966 of a heart attack, but his impact on the art world still lives on to this day. I was lucky enough to actually study with one of his students, Betsy Ruprecht, during my time at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and there I did a class called Figure in Interior, which I still love to teach to this day. And the class was all about just looking at figures as planes in space and dissecting them as if you had a big block of wood in front of you and you're just carving out bits of it from this cube. And so I recommend anybody who, if you're going to figure drawing or you want to learn how to draw the figure and all these sorts of things, that's great. And often we get caught up in all these little things like anatomy and, you know, the line of action and gesture and all these sorts of things. But it's important to remember that there was an entirely different approach to form, to painting people in interiors, to painting still lifes, to painting all sorts of things. And a lot of this goes back to Hans Hofmann. And if you've ever heard about a color pushing forward in space or pulling back in space, push and pull, that's all about Hofmann. So you might not know it, but he's still likely had an impact on how you view painting and how you create your own works. If you're interested in this sort of thing, head on over to oko.academy, which is my school that I've created in Prague. It's a private painting school where I teach students, I mentor students, I have figure drawing nights, I have all these sorts of things, and we take a little bit more of an experimental approach as well to the figure. So if these sorts of things interest you, perhaps you need to come to Prague. Come to Prague and study for a little bit. I've got a studio, I've got easels, I've got lights, got what you need. Head on over to oko.academy and you can learn more about that. I'm your host, I'm Jeremiah Polacek. Please stay tuned for our next episode and thank you so much for listening to the podcast. And as always, happy painting.